Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan, and as I listen to my little intro, I realize I've never gotten to add my newest book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Your Negative Emotions. I don't push my books enough on my show, and I probably won't. But I do want to remind you that I do have a wonderful new book out, which first gives a whole new explanation of why we feel guilt, shame, and anxiety, how alien it is to our true nature, how it's an imposition through evolution that's very primitive, a kind of anger management control imposed on us tens of thousands and probably hundreds of thousands and more years ago to help us have automatic controls over our emotions, which now are just very suppressive, and how to liberate ourselves in three steps from those negative emotions by identifying them, by rejecting them, by replacing them with reason and love. So don't forget that I don't just write critical stuff about psychiatry. This book is an outgrowth of earlier papers and books I've written, but it's really the culmination of a lot of my thinking about how to be strong, rational, loving, and creative in life. So check out Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. My guest today, John Rappaport. John is a radical man because he applies reason to public affairs. He also applies ethics to public affairs. When you apply reason and ethics to public affairs, you get labeled radical, dissident, or whatever else. John's been doing this for probably now more than 30 years, and we go back a long way. And John has been one of my strongest supporters over the years before it was cool to support me. Now it can even be cool. I'm well enough known. And John helped in that process of getting well known, and he still occasionally, just last week, which made me think of him again. I should have him on more often. I was doing somebody called me to do a radio show and hadn't done before or hadn't done a long time, and they said, John Rappaport, of course, mentions your name. So John, he's a really interesting man. I'll let him explain to you the next thing I'm going to say, and that is from his little bio, the author of three explosive collections, The Matrix Revealed, Exit from the Matrix, Power Outside the Matrix. So I think that will be very interesting information. John's written for a host of different magazines and newspapers and given lectures. He also, which I didn't know, has a private consulting practice for helping people expand personal creative power. Well, he's already helped me expand my personal creative power by his support. John uses the moniker No More Fake News. No More Fake News. I think you can get him on the web at No More Fake News. And I'll let him tell you more about himself as I introduce the audience again. I've had him on before, to John Rappaport. Hi, John.
Hi, Peter. Great to be here, as always.
As always, my friend. Want to tell us about The Matrix Revealed, Exit from the Matrix, and Power Outside the Matrix?
Yes. As you said, these are very large collections. People can read about them at No More Fake News. But I would start with the idea that we live in a society where, as always, I think from the dawn of history, it's been true, the people who rule are really operating on the basis of a stimulus response principle. They are looking to find the most effective stimuli that they can produce that will evoke from the population the desired responses. That's a strategy which was perhaps formalized by Pavlov and others, of course, conditioned reflex. But long before that, it was well understood that this is how you dealt with masses and masses of people. And one of the bases of my work over the years and the decades has been to illustrate this, show it, expose it, explain it, and talk about freedom and imagination and creative power as some of the elements that lie beyond stimulus response for the individual and for society. And so that's where really these collections start from. That's where my investigations began. And I was just thinking before we came on the air, because I know that we're going to talk about medical subjects and especially medical drugs, that this could not be a truer capsule explanation of the pharmaceutical companies. They are always looking for the kinds of stimuli that they can use with doctors, with the public through ads, with government agencies, with their vast audience to produce the desired response, which is that we must have these drugs. They're all wonderful. They're all necessary. We can't live without them. How did we ever survive before? And people must become lifelong patients, obeying the dictates of doctors from cradle to grave. So that is certainly one aspect of the matrix, the medical matrix, and I have done many investigations of it over the years, and I'm sure we'll get to some of that today.
Keep on talking. I think this idea, I really think that this is true. I've never put it in the words you're putting it in, but it's true. Those guys sit around, they think up, all right, what's a great something that'll change your life. I like the name Prozac, and they kick names around, and then they come up with it, and then they figure out, you know, what are we going to stimulate here? Well, we'll get the word out that people are depressed. No more of this anxiety stuff that was cued in with Valley, and we got new cues, new keys. I'm sure they're doing that.
Absolutely. They do it all the time. And then, of course, their ad people need to come up with slogans, you know, whatever that slogan is now for one of the, drugs like Cialis or whatever it is, you know.
Or just simply you have a biochemical imbalance.
Yes, exactly. That, of course, is not only for the public, but it's also for researchers and government agencies and their allies. Well, we need a basis for this. How do we describe what's wrong with people's brains so that we have some basis for the whole operation that we're doing with psychiatric drugs? So a chemical imbalance in the brain. Yes, that sounds wonderful, doesn't it? Forget the fact that we don't even know what a baseline normal chemical balance would be in the brain, or that it would be such an utterly complex thing to try to figure out. We can bypass all that and just go to the slogan, which we will claim is a scientific fact, that this is the root of all mental illness and mental disorders, the chemical imbalance hypothesis, but we'll call it a fact. Your chemicals are unbalanced, and people say, oh, yeah, I can understand that. And so what's the solution? We will balance it with these chemicals that we sell. That's the stimulus response promotion, PR propaganda message at work. And so everything gets reduced down to that, which is, of course, completely absurd.
Talk some more. I just think what you've got to say is really important. You're extremely cogent and insightful. So tell us more about what you've learned about this stimulus response stuff and how it gets implemented.
Well, of course, the idea behind, if we would talk, say, about psychiatric drugs, but really all medical drugs, is that they work in the body by stimulus response. You have a problem. a disease, an illness, a disorder, whatever it is. And so we give you the drug, and automatically the problem is corrected. And this is very comforting to many people because it doesn't seem to leave any room for problems or errors or mistakes or questions. God forbid any questions about this. It's all very simple, you see. You have this problem. For example, I remember a doctor who saw a friend of mine who had some serious difficulties in her life. And he basically said to her, well, you have a deficiency of Ativan. Now, that's your problem. And I'm going to remedy it by writing a prescription. And then you'll have your answer. And that's all we need to talk about. And nice to meet you. So this is the whole theory, really, behind modern medicine, as far as the drugs are concerned, that it all works according to stimulus response. And when people bring up objections and say, well, you know, there are some people who aren't responding as you predict they will. In fact, when we talk about SSRI antidepressants like Prozac and Zoloft, there are people who are pushed over the edge into violence, including suicide and homicide. And then, of course, the response is, well, there are extremely rare occurrences in which something like what you're describing might occur. But overwhelmingly, these drugs are safe, effective, and are wonderful advances. And of course, we're doing new research all the time and coming up with better drugs. Stimulus response. This is really the theory of modern medicine. The body is in need of a particular stimulus in order to evoke a particular response, and we, the drug lords, the pharmaceutical companies, have figured this out, and we know exactly what to provide. Well, the truth, as it turns out, is far from that, to say the least. Not only are individuals unique, but we discover the fact, for example, that the FDA is often in collusion with these drug companies to proclaim the drugs are safe and effective when they are dangerous and ineffective. And so you have a government agency which is certifying and approving of this stimulus response mechanism by saying, yes, this drug does it, and this drug does it, and this drug does it, and so forth and so on. It's all in the aid of this really enormous Pavlovian scheme to convince one and all that we are nothing more than biological machines that operate according to very set and narrow rules, and that the best researchers have figured out how this works, so they know what inputs to make that will give us the optimum response. That's the overall paradigm that we've been working under for a very long time. And the results are catastrophic, really, which I've been documenting for a long time, not just in the psychiatric field, but overall. And doctors even are now waking up to this, as well as some researchers and certainly reporters and the public. For example, and I've often cited this, and I believe it was really the first major breakthrough review, July 26, 2000, Journal of the American Medical Association, Dr. Barbara Starfield, who at the time was a revered public health expert working at Johns Hopkins, published a review called "Is U.S. Health Really the Best in the World?" in which she concluded that every year in the U.S., the medical system kills 225,000 people. And of those, 106,000 directly from FDA-approved and correctly prescribed pharmaceutical drugs. So if you just look at the drug effects there, you're talking about over 1 million deaths per decade caused by medical drugs, among which would be psychiatric drugs and heart drugs and cancer drugs, et cetera, et cetera. And this was a bombshell, which was for the most part, ignored by the press. I interviewed Dr. Starfield at length, not long before she died in 2009, and she told me that hers was a conservative estimate, number one. Number two, that no government agency had ever been in contact with her for her consultancy on how to fix this problem, of which they were well aware, and that no government agency had initiated any kind of remedial program to change this situation. In fact, if you go to the FDA's own website, the last time I looked, it was still there, you can Google FDA, why learn about adverse drug effects. You will see on the FDA's own website that they state in capital letters that every year in the United States, 100,000 people die as a result of medical drugs. And yet, they claim no responsibility for it whatsoever. They blithely state it on their website when they are the sole agency responsible for declaring these drugs safe and effective before they're released for public consumption. So that kind of takes us down the rabbit hole a little bit. But again, I return to the basis of all of this, which is the paradigm of stimulus response, that the drug companies have convinced one and all is legitimate, useful, real, and a wonderful thing that we are living in this time. They, the drug companies, will give you the stimuli, your body will respond, and health will overtake sickness. And that's all there really is to know about it and to talk about it. And beyond that, all they need is approval of the drugs and the ability to market them at very high prices all over the world, which, by the way, is part of what these latest trade treaties like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and so forth are really all about, to enable drug companies to continue to sell their drugs all over the world without having to worry about tremendous dents in their profits. So that's kind of my opening shot on all of this.
Well, we've got psychiatry, which we talk about a lot on the show, but your interests are indeed broader than that. And I'd be really happy to hear you pick up on this as an overall medical problem. I used to hope that psychiatry, the field I know best, and the FDA approval process for psychiatric drugs, which I know best and know well, was really the most corrupt aspect of the whole approval of the whole issue of creating new medications and getting them approved. I've begun to doubt that as I've learned more and more about, for example, the drugs for cholesterol, the anti-cholesterol drugs. So I'd love you to expand what you're saying with the same clarity that you've been doing. Expand it to this whole issue. What goes on with the FDA and medical drugs in general?
Well, an example, a reporter named Martha Rosenberg interviewed an FDA drug reviewer, former, named Ronald Kavanaugh. And that was an explosive interview, which part of which I've reproduced at No More Fake News. It was originally published at a site called Truth Out. And what Kavanaugh basically said was that he was threatened at his job because he was trying to do the honest thing and decide whether a drug was really safe before it was approved. And these threats escalated to the point where it was implied that he and his family, including his children, were under potential threat. I mean, we're now talking about mafia-like activity inside the FDA, which most people just don't want to think about as a possibility, but it's there. He said, for example, that he was told on another occasion, here is the report on a drug that we are now considering, a medical drug. We want you to read the following sections. His bosses told him this at the FDA. So he immediately knew that there were other sections they didn't want him to read. And he went to those sections, and sure enough, there was evidence that the drug was dangerous. And on another occasion, he was in the company of a drug company executive in a meeting where the executive bragged basically that his company had paid the FDA to get the approval for a drug, bribed the FDA to get approval for a drug. And of course, drug companies now, under recent regulations, pay the FDA to consider a new drug. They pay a fee to the FDA. So the number one client of the FDA is the drug companies, and they serve those clients. Not always, not in every case, not all the time, but overwhelmingly that is so. And to just expand out even further, in my investigations, once I had nailed down the Starfield study that I mentioned earlier and other supporting citations about deaths and severe adverse reactions in America every year from medical drugs, I then began to look in wider areas. For example, medical journals. They publish the results of clinical trials of these drugs. So how could it be that on balance, these reports published in prestigious journals give a free pass to these drugs as being safe and effective when we have statistics like a million people every year in the U.S. killed by these drugs? There must be across the board fraud within the medical journals themselves to be publishing studies that are obviously not true. And then I came across a statement from the New York Review of Books. I don't have the complete accurate quote in front of me, from Marcia Angell, Dr. Angell, who was for two decades an editor at the New England Journal of Medicine, perhaps the most prestigious medical journal in the world, in which she basically said that reluctantly after two decades, she came to the conclusion that these reports and clinical guidelines and so forth for drugs could not be trusted. She could not trust them anymore. She was basically admitting that the whole thing was a sham. The peer review process, the studies carried out by the drug companies, the doctors, the researchers, the whole thing was a shadow play, a false reality. And very reluctantly, she came to admit that. So I began talking to other reporters, some of whom I've known over the years, who work for mainstream outlets and sometimes write on medical issues. And, you know, after figuratively pulling a few teeth, got them to admit that there was territory in which they were forbidden to tread. They could assail a particular drug company on a particular drug that had been exposed as causing, you know, tens of thousands of heart attacks or something on that order. But to connect the dots, all the drug companies, the overall effects of these medical drugs on how many people they kill every year, 2.1 million serious adverse reactions every year in the U.S., No. They couldn't go near that. They couldn't get that kind of material published. They certainly couldn't investigate it on an ongoing basis. Why? Well, obviously because drug company advertising pays a huge chunk of the advertising fees of mainstream media outlets. But beyond that, what they were intimating to me and what I inferred from these conversations and from my research is there are certain stories which would shake the very pillars and the foundations of what people take to be reality. And since they get their reality from the media mainstream every day, if the mainstream exposed certain kinds of stories that were just mind-boggling, it would become contagious. What else about society that we all believe might be a complete fraud? What are we being lied to in other areas? And this story, which I often quoted to them because I've written that article in many different ways many times, about medical system causing 225,000 deaths a year in the U.S., they said that would be one of those stories. It would shape and crack the pillars of what people accept to be comfortable reality in their lives, in their perception of the world. And that is a place where major media cannot go. And if they tried to push this with their editors, the editors would look at them askance and say, do you realize what you're endangering here? Your job, your career, your future as a reporter, if you insist on continuing to push this. And so they backed away, of course. And they also told me point blank that these major media outlets pretty much run like machines. The reporters, the editors, the senior editors, all the way up the line and all the way down the line. They know what they can do, what they can say, and what they can't do, and what they can't say. It's reached the point now where very rarely does anybody have to intercede and say, you're treading a dangerous ground. Everybody knows his place. Everybody follows the rules. Occasionally, somebody might push the line a little bit, but that's about it. Can't go any further than that. And that is why, actually, with the advent of internet news, independent news, why many of these major outlets are having deep financial trouble. Because more and more of the public is realizing that the truth is really not to be found there, not the kind of truth that they're looking for. And so I began to see, well, in my own ballpark, so to speak, media reporting, that the fix was in on these medical stories, on the real effects of the medical establishment on the population, that this was in no way going to reach up into major media, that the objective of the game from this point on needed to be to bring more and more people out of the mainstream into independent news where they would get what they were really looking for, instead of trying to plead with major media to please cover this story. Don't you think this warrants attention, and so on and so forth. Yes, occasionally you can make headway there, but by the rest of the time, you've got to be doing something quite different.
I like the way you're putting it, John. And you and I, we have a lot of similar interests and critiques. You put it in a very special way when you give your insights. I think this is very, very valuable for people to hear. We're going to take a break in a minute. John, think about where you want to go with this after our brief break. I'd be happy to have you continue to just share your concepts of this matrix that we're all enmeshed in, and in particular about the media. And certainly I've been doing the media since the early 70s, and clearly in the major media now, lockstep is even more locked in. The conformity is even greater than it was a decade or two ago. Very, very much so. So we're talking with John Rappaport, and you can get him on the net through his name or No More Fake News. And Just keep educating us, John, when we come back in a very few minutes.
Okay.
And this is Peter Bregan again, continuing with my enormously insightful, hardworking, honest reporter, John Rappaport. John, just tell us more stuff.
Well, this media matrix that everybody is now immersed in, a flood of information, we have a situation, for example, I was just writing about this yesterday. The article is up, but no more fake news. Media giants, like the New York Times, for example, have been drowning in red ink for a long time. So they've had to refinance their debt several times. And now it looks like Facebook is coming to the rescue. Because Facebook has a new program, which it's initiating, called Instant Articles. And what this is major media outlets like the New York Times, BBC, NBC, will be able to place their articles directly on Facebook, which means that people will not have to click at Facebook and move out of that virtual bubble in order to get their news. They will be able to get it right there on Facebook. Now, the implications of this are enormous because Facebook has somewhere in the vicinity of 1.25 billion people using their mobile platform. And about 64% of the population is in and out of Facebook. So what that means is that these declining media giants, which, as I think most people know by now, are owned by a handful of gigantic corporations, will have new life, new exposure to vast global audience. And this is, regardless of how Facebook presents it, really an effort to save a dying empire, which is how I've been seeing this for the last 10 years or so, as I see the rise of independent news. As I see that people, I can't tell you how many people have emailed me on the issue of psychiatry, for example, and either directly asked how to find your website, Peter, or who I would recommend that they read to understand the truth about psychiatry, in which case I always give them your name. But it isn't just there. It's in every area. People want to know about health. There are now more and more of them going to Gary Noll. So we have essentially what we're looking at here. You can call it whatever you want to, but independent media entities where the truth can be found that have nothing to do with and no obligation to these mainstream media giants. That is a revolution in progress. That is definitely on the boards. It's happening. It's growing. More and more people are waking up. And among other things, what they're discovering is their own intelligence. Because, you know, if you're exposed to disinformation, half-truth, omitted vital facts for years and years and years and years because you've been taking your news from major media, unfortunately, you become less intelligent. You can't help it because these stories don't add up. They don't make sense. There's no context. There's no connection of dots. There's nothing that a really active, alive intellect would find satisfaction in. So as people leave that arena and go to independent researchers and independent media, they begin to discover, oh, look at this. Well, I was kind of thinking that might be the case. back to medical drugs again, I don't, can't tell you how many people have written me over the years with personal stories. This happened to me. This happened to my husband, my brother, my sister, and I tried to do something about it, and I was up against a brick wall, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Or people who just said, well, I've always suspected like something like this was going on in terms of medical drug damage, but I couldn't find anything about it in the media. And now I see you're writing many articles about this, and you're giving citations and references, and wow, they're waking up. People are waking up to the fact of their own intelligence, again, their own native intelligence, that is much more probing and inquisitive and sharp and less prone to accept things at face value. And to me, this might be the ultimate revolution as far as media is concerned, that once you're outside the bubble, you discover again, as I did as a reporter, as an investigator, gee, that course that I took in logic, those three courses back in college or two courses, that was really important, and I'm using this now, and I'm not only using it now, I'm using it far better than I ever imagined I could use it when I was 19 years old. I'm much smarter now than I was before, and I think a lot of people are realizing that. Well, that's infectious. That's a good disease. That's the kind of thing whereby a person will say, well, now that I realize that I really all along knew a lot of things about this area, medical, whatever it is, psychiatric, I suspected, and now I realize that was true. Well, let me start to look at other areas where major media have been predominant. U.S. foreign policy over the years, the, you know, industrial machine connected to the military and to intelligence agents. Let's look at this now for real. Yes, 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 yes. People wake up, and in waking up, they say, wow, I'm smarter than I thought I was. This is good. My life is better now. It's not, you know, I refute the idea that learning more and more of the truth is depressing. I don't think that's ultimately true.
No, it's exciting and empowering.
Exactly. It's exciting and empowering. And part of the reason it's exciting is because if you're smarter, a lot smarter this year than you were last year, you know it. You feel it. You experience it. It's a thrill. And you're inspired by it to live your life along that road further and further. So that's the revolution that we're seeing now.
It's certainly the revolution, obviously, that I participate in, too. This radio show, again, thanks to Gary Null, is one of the ways. And my Simple Truth videos have been out there, gotten over 250,000 downloads as of now, I think. I hope millions and millions someday. But tell me, what do you think the government's going to do about this? The government doesn't want you and me and Gary and so on doing all these things, and the big corporations certainly don't. I mean, I'm a target of the big corporations. What are the chances that all this is going to continue, or that this is just going to be the heyday of an internet freedom that gets shut down soon?
Yes, I've thought a lot about this. I don't think they can stop it. There are certain countries that can stop it. China, for example, can stop it if they want to, selectively, in how they decide to censor and so forth. And of course, there are countries in the world where censorship is the rule. So whether it's the internet or whether it's political speech in an assembly hall, you know, censorship is how they do business. But in other countries, like America, for example, the genie is so far out of the bottle that I don't really think they're going to be able to put it back. Now, they try various things. I mean, Facebook, for example, will censor certain stories, just shut them out. And they will give their reasons for doing it. And in some cases, people might say, well, that's a good idea. I don't. But in other cases, it's obvious to everybody that it's the truth that they're censoring. And so you see an effort, for example, like that. Or you see corporate paid trolls who go to various websites and try to disrupt things by making comments in the comments section and driving people crazy with their remarks and so forth and trying to smear the whole enterprise. So, yes, there are these various operations. But to wholly come in out of the blue and say, the following 5,000 websites are now shut down in America because we find that they are, criminally based, a threat to national security? On what basis are they going to do that? So I think their plan, as you say, is to lock down major media tighter and tighter and tighter so that they feel that through that medium they will be able to control public opinion. That's their estimate or their hope, which I think is completely misplaced. It's not going to work in the long term. So we're in a struggle here, and the outcome is not decided. And I don't think that overall Soviet-style censorship is going to be the response by government or big corporations. They're going to try to use more covert means. But I don't think they're going to win, because there are too many of us out there. I mean, untold numbers of people who are exposing the truth about various aspects of society, government, big corporations, the war machine, foreign policy, domestic policy. And sure, there are disagreements, sometimes very serious disagreements about what the truth is. But on balance, I would say we are winning. No question about it.
John, what's the best summary of your thoughts on this for people who have been listening to this show and they want to just hear more of exactly what you think about all this?
Well, I write almost daily articles, sometimes more than one every day at No More Fake News, which if you read back over the last few months, I think you begin to get where I'm coming from and what issues I cover and so on and so forth. And then for those people who want to go much, much deeper, the collections, matrix collections that you mentioned are also described on the website. And that's my one-man media operation. I mean, I've been doing it now for, 14 years. It started simply because as a reporter, I was already writing stories for what was being called alternative media back in the 1980s. And I found that I kind of reached an impasse with that because I wanted to do more adventurous work that would step on more toes. And I found it was very difficult to pitch my stories to editors on those subjects. So when the internet came along, I said, well, this is it. This is where I'm going to go. This is what I'm going to do.
Is there a book in the offing?
Not at the moment, no. But I have written several books, which you can find out about at my website. The first one was called AIDS, Inc., and maybe in some respects was the most explosive because I started from a zero point, thinking that the research on AIDS up to that point, 1986, there was something wrong with it, and I had no idea what that might be, but I decided that I would take a look at it, not with the idea of writing a book, just an article. And I met so many researchers and so many people that I began to get really into the depths of basic questions, like, how do you know or decide what causes a disease? What do you have to do in a laboratory in order to come up with that conclusion? What are the diagnostic tests? Are the tests reliable when they're done on patients? And, questions that well, a lot of people, certainly the mainstream medical reporters, never want to get into because the answers are very troubling. And that was my first real foray into the wilderness of contradictions and non-logic that pervades the entire medical system, including ultimately the research establishment where it all begins. And, you know, I'll say one interesting thing to me. At that time, I, who had zero reputation, could call up a public health agency like the CDC or the National Institutes of Health, or I could call a university like Harvard and say that I was writing a book on AIDS and talk to somebody in media relations, and they would put me through to the researcher and I would have a conversation on the relevant questions that I had. Not only that, but at the CDC specifically, there was a media relations guy that I must have called 25 times during the period I was writing the book. And he had to know after a while that what I was driving at was very, very corrosive to the whole scenario of what AIDS was and so forth that was being presented to the public by the CDC. And yet, he got answers to all my questions. He put me through on occasion to researchers. And that relationship, such as it was, continued right up to the time of the publication of the book. Well, today, talk about lockdown media. That would be absolutely laughable to imagine that you could do something like this. Laughable. No possible way I could even get in the door. Maybe nothing more than a voice message would I get now. Maybe a standard email reply. But it's harder now to find the information. But when you do, it's much easier to publish it and to get broad exposure of the information. So that's been a trend. And it's also a partial answer to your question, what do I think the powers that be are going to do? Well, that's one of the things they do. They lock you out of access to the people that you really want to talk about, because I'll tell you, I mean, I know a dozen independent medical reporters right off the bat who, if they had access to some of these famous medical bureaucrats and researchers and could tape a conversation with them, the results would be catastrophic and explosive for these government agencies and pharmaceutical companies. It would just be devastating. So we're locked out of that. Can't do that. But there are other ways of discovering the information, and I have found a growing, as I'm sure you have, Peter, in the area of psychiatry, a growing number of medical professionals who are coming out of their hypnotic state of indoctrination into what they've learned in medical school and are rebelling, basically, against the establishment. They are not following the party line. And some of them are willing to talk about it and write about it, and it's changing the landscape.
Not much in psychiatry. I mean, still most of the people who are just out there talking about these issues in my field would be psychologists, social workers, philosophers. In psychiatry, it's the lockdown is so complete because they have nothing to support anything they're doing, and the size of the disaster is getting larger and larger, so that the only option for a young person is who's a psychiatrist, is if they're going to see the truth, is basically to maybe try to make a living as a psychotherapist, which can be very marginal at times. There's not a lot of places for them to go.
I see. Well, that puts you more and more at the center of things. The thing that, you know, immediately made me feel very inspired when you and I met and I heard you speak and, of course, read toxic psychiatry, which I always return to, you know, the first blockbuster book that blew my mind, and when I've seen you interviewed, is that A, you're unstoppable, and B, just when somebody else on the other side thinks that they've got you, they don't. And not only do you reply cogently and clearly to what they say, but you back it up. You back it up with the truth, the citations, the studies, the revelations that they don't want to talk about. And they just, you know, crumble or fade into the woodwork, because whatever you say, if you need to, you can back it up to the hilt. And that's what we need more of and more of and more of. Because not only does that impress people, but it happens to be the truth. And when embodied in a personality like yours, who is relentless, and yet at the same time, you know, quite happy to be there, quite happy to disseminate the truth, you know, you have an unstoppable combination. So you're still at the center of all of this, for sure.
Yeah, I don't see a phalanx of young psychiatrists standing up on this issue, but there is quite a phalanx of people around the world, including yourself. I've been invited to go to talk in Copenhagen and then in London by Peter Goetsche, who is just come out with a new book on how horrible medications really are from a scientific viewpoint. And he's a medical doc, but not a psychiatrist. He just happened to run into what psychiatry was all about. But from within psychiatry, it's kind of like trying to expect an abolitionist to come out of slaveholders. It's going to come from the outside.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of it that is coming from the outside is very, very convincing, I must say this. I mean, Goetsche, the doctor you just mentioned, has now, you know, he comes out and says, look, in the U.S. and Europe, medical drugs are now the third leading cause of death. Wow. You know, this is an MD doctor just saying, here it is, folks. This is what's going on. And that stimulates, shall we say, back to stimulus response, but in a good way, it stimulates people to start thinking, well, if that's true, then what have I been believing all this time? I had better get busy here and figure out what's going on. I need other sources of information other than the New York Times and CBS to figure out what's happening here. So I do see very good things going on in this area.
Yes, things are. I'm going to be in Denmark on September 14th and in London on September 18th as part of just a colossally exciting conferences bringing together some of the most trenchant critics and very scientifically oriented critics of the current psychiatric establishment. I'll try to get something up on my website right now or in the next few days. But if you follow up on Peter Goetsche's work, you'll also find the conference. But we'll be hoping to meet folks who have heard me on the radio in Copenhagen and London. John, we're just about at the end. Tell us, what do you want to say for one minute?
1 minute.
What do you want to say? You know, I've been much quieter than I usually am, folks. John speaks with such authority and such thoughtfulness. He's a man who's been thinking deeply his whole life, and I just sit back a little and listen. But what would you like to conclude here? Anything inspiring?
Sure. Well, first of all, as always, I've really enjoyed this conversation with you. Waking up is hard to do at the beginning, but it's doable. You get a hold of, and I'm talking to your audience, of course, here, you get a hold of some piece of information that you nail down or somebody else has nailed down, and you see it's true, and you say, well, now this is real. I can stand on this. And when I do stand on it, then I look around and everything begins to look different now. It's not the same. That's a clue. That's called a clue. Because now you can keep going on that basis. What's the next step you're going to stand on? And how much of a vista are you going to be able to see now and understand? So that's my remark, Peter. And thank you again.
Thank you, John Rappaport. Thank you.